Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming into from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing in the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that'll determine what the future will bring. And I need to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're looking at or listening to. They're my views and the views of our guests. And for the first hour this evening, we're going to have John Longnecker, and we're going to be talking about his book on the transfer of wealth, but of course this talks about a lot of other issues. And so with that as a background, John, thank you very much for being with us this evening.
Thanks, Dr. Stan. Thanks very much for having me.
Well, now, why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself, introduce yourself to our listeners, and certainly your background and why you wrote the book.
Well, fundamentally, 30 years ago, I was one of the first paramedics in Los Angeles County. And when we saw our share of GSW's gunshot wounds, they were largely crime-on-crime shootings, based on my first-hand experience, and I became a little interested, and I asked, you know, where is all the self-defense shooting? And over the last three decades, I got my answer from some very diligent researchers, and I decided, you know, that there's something very curious about why so many people are interested in taking guns instead of taking the situation in hand. And in my own research, I was able to discover that the Founding Fathers, in their original intent, wrote the Second Amendment to the Constitution of the United States that had nothing to do with you and me, and it had nothing to do with guns. And what it really had to do with was the idea of abuse of the law. In the time that they were living under the Crown of England, one of the things they revolted against in the War for Independence was abuse of due process. The Crown kept moving the goalposts. So you could always be certain that you were breaking the law, uncertain as to whether you were in compliance with the law, but you could always be certain of some sort of punishment. And so when they broke from the Crown, they wrote that such abuse of due process would be forbidden. And in order to back that civilian authority, where the founders believed the citizens to be the supreme authority of the land, they gave them all due force. And that force cannot be infringed. So they wrote the law that did not apply to you and me, Doctor. It applies to the government. And they did not imagine weapons of the future, such as AK-47s. All they could think of was forbidding abuses of due process. So now we have more than one amendment to the Bill of Rights that is absolute, and that is absolutely impervious to due process, short of another amendment to the Constitution. And until that very hour, there can be no such thing as a sensible gun law or an illegal gun.
No, what you're basically talking about, of course, is the Second Amendment and the admonition that the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be abridged.
That's right. And, you know, it is being infringed by political sway, by deception, by punishment and discouraging of spirit, and this is an abuse of due process. When officials such as Dianne Feinstein or gun control advocates operating under anti-violence treatises, they always say, we need to take guns, you need to turn them in, America. What they're really doing is attacking the legal force which backs our sovereign authority against officials, and they're using violent crime as the device to wedge the resolve away from our authority.
And of course, they always talk about the children. Oh, the children. Oh, my goodness. We need to protect the children. That's why we've got to take the guns away from the law-abiding adult citizens. But then the question is, who's going to protect the children, you know, when the criminal comes in to... Well, John, go right ahead.
When I was an EMT, I always wanted to go to paramedic school. I spent 2.5 years as an emergency medical technician in the 1970s, and then I finally got into paramedic school. And at that time, all paramedics were CPR instructors, certified by the Heart Association as just part of the normal curriculum, because we were often called on to instruct CPR classes. Now, the reason that we had lay CPR was this. In the middle 70s, I was a chief paramedic, and I was contacted by the American Heart Association, along with several hundred other chief paramedics across the country, to please participate in a panel that had been set up almost city by city by the Heart Association. And they wanted paramedics to speak a particular enunciation that couldn't really come from nurses or police officers or even physicians. The whole idea was to get physicians and attorneys behind the idea of training citizens in CPR. At the time, the objections from the physicians were, well, why didn't we just leave it to the professionals, such as yourself, Chief? And I said, well, that's because your way of thinking, Doctor, is that in a cardiac arrest situation, your crash cart is 10 paces down the hall. But in the field, during a cardiac arrest situation, and you know that in a cardiac arrest, brain death begins in 4 minutes, we cannot always arrive with a life-saving response time of under 3 minutes. Therefore, we need to train citizens to keep the lid on with artificial circulation and artificial respiration until the advanced life support can arrive on scene and take over. All of a sudden, the light bulbs came on, and our mission was completed. And as you know, today, citizen CPR is now known as bystander CPR, and over 20 million persons understand it well enough to save a life. Now, this is landmark. Doctor, there is an absolute identity of values between concealed carry of weapons, personal authority, and CPR, citizen CPR, and first aid. Because just as the individual advanced life support cannot arrive with a life-saving response time all the time, neither can the police. And it's very important to understand now, in that frame, how crime is used to disarm the productive sovereign in our society, and how it's absolutely critical that every American who doesn't know anything about guns learn what their sovereign authority is and what the Second Amendment was really written for. And that is the lethal force which backs citizen authority.
Hold that thought. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and John has made an excellent point. He, of course, was with the emergency technician, and of course went on a tour, you know, addressing groups many times of physicians who were saying, well, why don't we simply leave the responsibility for cardiac resuscitation up to us professionals, us doctors, because we're so much better prepared to do that than the people in the field. And of course John's point was, yes, but if you're not in the field, that person is going to die unless they have immediate CPR. And certainly it's great when we get them to the hospital, but if we can't get to the hospital, they're going to die. We need to have the people, the average citizen, understand cardiac pulmonary resuscitation, and we're going to save an awful lot of lives that way. And, you know, if you can absolutely guarantee there'll be a doctor at every emergency site, then fine, we don't need to teach people. But since you obviously cannot, then we need to have citizens learn cardiac and pulmonary resuscitation, and that's exactly what has happened. And then he carries that idea over into the guns. Certainly, the police can't always be there to protect us. So we have to have the citizens protecting us against the criminal element. Certainly, if you're going to have gun laws, why the criminals are not going to abide by the gun laws. The gun laws are not aimed at criminals or cutting back on gun crimes or even in protecting children at all. I mean, this is all the excuse to disarm the people. The reality is, of course, when you begin to pass gun laws, why you restrict the ability of citizens to protect themselves and their family and children. and there are many, many children who've been brutalized and killed and raped and destroyed because there was nobody there with a gun to protect them. And since you can't have a policeman in every home, then the people need to be have their weapons and be prepared to defend themselves.
You know, Doctor, there's something else, too, that every American household should understand. You know, families work very hard to protect themselves and their children and their heritage and their legacy. And they plan for root canal, they plan for unemployment, they plan for traffic accident by insuring their vehicles. They have medical insurance. They have all kinds of plans in anticipation of some kind of an untoward event. But for all the houses in the United States, all the American households, how the American household will meet, respond to, and survive any kind of an encounter with violent crime is the most neglected area of household management. Now, these people are good-hearted folks, and they believe, well, why don't we let the professionals handle it? We would dial 911. But here's something that's very important in the identity of values between concealed carry and citizen volunteerism in CPR, and that is not only authority, not only the idea that the first responders cannot arrive with the life-saving response time, but the fact that in all 50 states, it's not their job. The Supreme Court has held as recently as 2005, and since the inception of an organized police force in the middle 1800s, police have no duty to protect individuals, even in the presence of a restraining order. It is just not among their charter. They have no duty to come in time and save you. So not only can they not be there practically and tactically, they're under no such obligation to come and protect you.
And because this is why people have to be prepared to protect themselves increasingly as we move into an increasingly violent society. And of course, as has been pointed out so well in studies of communities where they have a gun, concealed carry laws, you find far less crime and violence in areas where there is a concealed carry law than in areas where the citizens are unarmed and the criminal knows it.
Well, the idea is that you want to keep the criminal guessing. You know, Doctor, we had the multiple shooting at Virginia Tech, and a lot of the people still thought, well, I don't know why we couldn't call the police. Why was there a delay? This delay was light years compared to what could have happened if someone had been able to pick up a phone and gotten through the dispatcher, because Mr. Cho had killed 20 people before anybody could even get to a telephone. He knew, like many school shooters know, that these people are totally disarmed and that they will not return fire, and that before any law enforcement agent can arrive, he will have done his dirty deed and then commit suicide for the purposes of evading justice. Individuals in concealed carry states, even there, on campus, they are barred from carrying their personal weapon. Why? When individuals have the authority to bring up to lethal force in self-defense, and they have the legal authority to come to the aid of another, and they have the right for the purpose of not allowing crime to overrun a community, why is a university interested in obfuscating that authority? Not just the legal right, but the legal authority to answer with up to lethal force. This is baffling. And I think that every community needs to mobilize and dictate to the officials who took an oath of office that they will be permitted to carry their weapon. In fact, there should be no question whatsoever as to what is allowed or disallowed. The individual, as an adult, should be free to carry his weapon wherever police can be summoned, because he already is possessed of that authority, and it is civilian authority that grants authority to law enforcement.
Well, you know,
they've got it all backwards.
Well, the thing is that every school in the United States, according to federal law, is an open shooting gallery for anybody who wants to go in and shoot and kill, because they know that no one will have a weapon there. Why would you have a law that stupid? I mean, the thing is that if you want to defend the people, Let the teachers have a weapon. Let law-abiding citizens have a weapon, and people are not going to come in and start shooting them. They're only going to come in when they are assured there's not going to be any opportunity for anybody to shoot them until, as you say, they've done their vile and terrible deed.
The rideshow was planning on committing suicide anyway. He was very angry, and most violent acts are pure anger. And it's very hard to stop them because sometimes the only thing that you can do is meet them with lethal force. Now, here's another interesting little figure for the hounds that are interested in statistics. Doctor, do you know how many people are shot to death each year in the United States?
No, I really don't.
According to the FBI, about 29,500, roughly. 29,500 by various guns, shotguns, crime on crime, suicide, accidental discharge, children, they all add up to be just under 30,000. Now, how many people in America use a gun to stop a crime from escalating in this country? Take a guess.
I would not be able to, but you tell me.
According to the same source, the FBI's Uniform Crime Report, 2.5 million times a year.
And so we prevent an awful lot of crimes because there are weapons in the hands of law-abiding citizens.
That's right. And most of those are in the states where guns are fairly routine. Concealed carry states, right-to-carry states, all kinds of things. And they have fewer of the so-called victim disarmament zones. The individual who might contemplate violence has to think twice because he doesn't know if his target is armed or not. And that's a good thing. As long as we keep them guessing. We've made the point. But the idea is, who are we to take the law into our own hands? One of the chief objections. Well, the idea is that because we have that legal authority, the law is already on scene in the citizen. The law is already there. Now, it's important to understand that in these 2.5 million de-escalations turned into the FBI every year, not only are many of them underreported, because sometimes they just aren't turned into the local police in order to be turned into the FBI, there's also the discovery that if the crime of violence is de-escalated without even discharging the weapon. Happy ending for both sides now. Either the aggressor bolts and leaves, or is held for police, and only a very few times, falling within that 29,000, maybe only 3,500, because most of the crimes are shootings are crime on crime, only a tiny percentage are actually shot in self-defense. That's answered my question many, many years ago. Where are all the self-defense shootings? If people are using guns to protect themselves, where are the stories? Well, I found them. It so happens they took control of the situation and did not need to shoot the weapon. It works because they have the authority and they have the force. Crime in this country, Doctor, cannot be used as a device for social engineering.
And this is what it's all about. And then there are also people who hate individual freedom and realize that, you know, this idea of an armed populace goes against their plan for an authoritarian society.
Mm-hmm.
There really are people who'd like to have an authoritarian society, the Dianne Feinsteins of the world, who want to have the right for them to carry a weapon, but not for anybody else to carry a weapon. This woman is a hypocrite. She had a gun permit. She carried a gun when she was the mayor of San Francisco because she said, well, she was afraid her life was in danger.
That's right.
But, of course, she's objected to anybody else having a gun. The same is true with Rosie O'Donnell. She has armed bodyguards. But, of course, she doesn't want us to have a weapon. These people have a different worldview. And I think until we understand that there is an agenda behind what's going on, it isn't logical, because the statistics show that the more guns that there are in the hands of law-abiding citizens, the less crime. The less guns in the hands of law-abiding citizens, the more crime. Washington, D.C., our nation's capital, a perfect example. We'll be back in just a moment with John Longdecker. John, go right ahead.
Well, Doctor, you know, there are many reasons for individuals, heads of household, to consider learning how to shoot.
Gold and silver is tremendously undervalued. Global demand vastly exceeds mine supply by more than 60% annually. There is little in the financial world more certain than a coming explosion in the prices of gold and silver. The U.S. dollar continues to lose value and respect as the world's reserve currency. Our nation faces challenges on many fronts, and a day doesn't pass without another economist bringing forth warnings of impending economic calamity. There has never been a better time than right now to acquire physical gold and silver. Discount Gold and Silver Trading was founded on the principles of truth and honesty. We believe in providing a quality product, quality service, and most importantly, competitive pricing. We provide all forms of precious metals, including American gold, silver, platinum, and rare investment and circulated coins. Silver bars, rounds, and 90% silver bags are on hand for the silver investor. Gold self-directed IRAs are available. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188. Toll free, that's 1-800-375-4188.
Most Americans are iodine deficient today because they stopped adding iodine to our milk and to our flour, and only about half of the salt that's consumed in the United States today contains iodine. So Radio Liberty has produced a four tape or a four CD set that discusses the health benefits of iodine. We also offer iodorol. It contains 12.5 milligrams of iodine per tablet. And we also offer potassium iodide tablets that'll protect your thyroid gland in case there's a nuclear attack. So if you'd like to order these products or obtain additional information, why don't you call 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927. Or go to our website at RadioLiberty.com. That's RadioLiberty.com. Once again, our telephone number, 1-800-544-8927.
You got headaches? Most headaches are caused by a structural weakness of blood vessels in the head, and the blood vessels are tending to balloon, causing a headache. The structural weakness is due to a deficiency. Correct the deficiency, and the body will heal itself. I blended what I believed to be the missing nutrients in the right proportions, and the headaches went away. When they were gone, they stayed gone. I named it Headache Stay Gone. See HeadacheStayGone.com or call 800-327-0727 for more information or to place an order. I'll send you a bottle of Headache Stay Gone. Headache Stay Gone will cure your headaches and prevent them from coming back before you pay the bill. Headache Stay Gone has already cured the worst migraines I have ever heard of. Call 800-327-0727. All orders are shipped the same day. Call 800-327-0727. That's 800-327-0727.
Hi, this is Dr. Tony Teary. Are you one of the many people who take vitamin supplements? Do you take handfuls of pills each day to increase energy, reduce your pain, or improve your overall health? Now there is a better way to get the vitamins and minerals your body needs in a delicious-tasting whole food liquid supplement, Body Balance. Body Balance contains 121 essential vitamins and minerals and is made from only organic and natural sources. Developed by doctors, Body Balance was originally available only through healthcare professionals. Now this incredible whole food liquid supplement can be delivered directly to your home. Body Balance offers an extremely effective method to feed your body towards wellness, and we're confident you'll love the difference your body feels. To order your Body Balance, call me directly at 1-800-768-9763 and try it risk-free for 45 days. Again, that's 1-800-768-9763 or online at healthyfoundations.net.
And in Canada and Australia, after they disarmed the people, a much higher rate of gun crime because the law-abiding citizens obey the law. The criminal now knows they have free rein because they're not going to get shot. Well, as Andy John was just talking about, how if we're involved, we can accomplish great and wonderful things, pointing out that recently, within the last few weeks, when they were trying to get through the amnesty bill, there were so many calls and so much pressure brought on members of the House represent, specifically in this instance on the Senate, that the Senate, even though many of the senators wanted to vote in favor of amnesty and allowing people who violated our laws to stay in the country, why they just could not bring themselves to do it for fear that their constituents would rise up and get them out of office. So I think, as John points out, that was a beautiful example of what happens when the American people become involved. Go ahead, John.
And when they want to apply that kind of authority to any issue, then they're doing their civic duty. Too many Americans are just lazy. They won't get involved, or they don't know how. But these are two fabulous examples of what happens, and quickly, when they get involved. Now, you know darn good and well that a lot of these elected officials don't know what's going on, and they depend on their staff to give them the input. They depend on their staff to read the bills. They depend on their staff and their handlers. And a lot of these individuals, a lot of the people who go to vote on the floor, don't even understand the doggone issues. If they are reached by their constituents, they ought to understand them a lot better than what their handlers have been turning in. And when it comes to violent crime, if they begin to understand how they have been duped by handgun control crowds, people who say we need to stop trafficking, we need to put the assault weapons dismantled back in the mothballs, we need to turn in our guns. All of these things are basically one-sided. They haven't heard the other side. Only a handful of people running for the White House, running for the Oval Office at this time, understand it, but they haven't even gone so far as to attend a machine gun shooting fundraiser that was recently held in New Hampshire. Now, this is important because even the conservatives who talk about liberty, who talk about personal freedom, talk about government being a servant of the people, will not stand up for what they stand for. And when it comes to the authority of the people, backed by lethal force, they will not stand for it. Now, that worries me. What we need to do is educate a lot more Americans in what the original intent of the Second, the Ninth, and Tenth Amendment really are. And that is, you must be possessed of the force which backs your authority, so that you cannot be subject to crime, which can then be turned around as a device for social engineering. You cannot be talked out of it. You cannot be sold on the idea that it can be voted in or voted out. You cannot be convinced of the idea that the government will determine what is allowed and what is not allowed when it is the citizen who is in charge. It's this kind of education that we need to get out there.
Don't you really think that what we need is for a course for everybody who's running for political office, a course in what the Constitution means and the fact that the Constitution means what it says. And that when it says the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be abridged, it doesn't mean, well, of course you can have guns, but you can't have automatic weapons, or, you know, you can have guns, but you can't have a 50 caliber rifle, or you can have guns, but they've got to be locked up someplace. I mean, there is no justification for the gun laws because they are a violation of our Constitution. There's no question.
That's right. And each and every word of any gun regulation or any regulation of ammunition or who may carry or where they may carry violates so many American doctrines, the doctrine of the average reasonable person, the standing in the shoes of another, the tactical idea that the police cannot be everywhere at once, the authority of the individual. All of these things are just a slap in the face to discourage citizen involvement. If we exercise citizen involvement, if we fully understand that we are the authority in this country, if we understand that weapons are in fact the force which backs our authority, and if we understand that crime is merely a tool for people to advance more and more programs so that they can cultivate greater dependency on them, then we lose our independence. That's what makes them rich.
And powerful. We're going to be back in just a moment with Sean Longdecker and discussing his book, and we'll tell you more about it very shortly. Well, John, you go right ahead there.
You know, doctor, the question is, how can I get involved? Well, there's two ways that you can get involved as an individual within this audience. One, go to somebody you say that you trust who owns a gun, and you say three little words that most liberty enthusiasts love to hear, and that is, take me shooting. And when you go shooting with somebody, you learn not only the mechanism and the safety and the handling of the weapon, but you understand what it's all about. You may get a long-winded lecture from somebody shooting at the range, but you'll come to understand by the end of the afternoon what guns are really for and what they're all about. The second thing that a head of a household can do is to run for public office. Most individuals who feel the spirit moving them to make a difference in their community are eligible to throw their hat in the ring for a legislative position within their state legislature or maybe in their party where they can join their central committee. And oftentimes there are opportunities to join the central committee within every district. And if you communicate well with the central committee, and if you work to be elected, and it is an office of appointment, and then later on you have to get reelected, then you can participate in the process and ultimately get involved in naming the candidate who will represent your district in your state capital. You can also get involved in other related runs for Congress. And all of this stuff gives you a little bit more leverage. It's something that you can do and make all the difference and turn this around. Now, once an individual head of a household comes to the realization that how they will handle crime and how crime is a device as a social agenda, once you come to that realization, you decide, I'm going to go with somebody and they're going to teach me how to shoot. You have begun to turn the entire thing around in a single night. Now we can reverse direction. And that's going to be something you're going to hand down to your children. Because if we don't hand down these values, we might as well hand them over. And that's why we're not working for today's patriotism, we're working for tomorrow's. We have ours today thanks to our previous generation. The patriotism and the freedom that we enjoy today was repurchased, was continually supervised by this generation gone. Now it's incumbent upon us, because what we do today we'll give to tomorrow. That's what it's all about. It's all about tomorrow. And so we need to go to somebody and say, take me shooting. We need to consider running for office, or at least getting involved, because we want to select better, well,
hold
and
that
better
thought,
candidates.
Hold that thought. We'll be right back here. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest this evening is John Longnecker. He's extremely articulate and presents his position very convincingly, and that is that we should all have a weapon. We should be prepared to defend ourselves, and, well, if you don't really want to have a weapon in your house, that's fine, but at least a criminal won't know that you don't have a weapon, and the more weapons are out there, the fewer criminals there's going to be. In fact, the more guns there are, the less crime. This has been statistically shown time and time again. It's only logical. Criminals don't want to get shot. They want to be able to shoot you. They want to be able to intimidate you. But they certainly don't want to get hurt themselves. Well, John, before we go on, I want you to get your website out and let our listeners know how they can get hold of your book.
My regular column is called Good for the Country. It's my regular feature. It's in syndication, but it normally appears first at my website called goodforthecountry.com. It's a patriotic website. It talks about the latest feature article that I have on my opinion, unasked as it is. And it has a couple of other features on the website, such as my upcoming talk radio bookings and that sort of thing. The other thing is that the book itself can be found at any online bookstore or ordered at any brick-and-mortar store. Called Transfer of Wealth, the Case for Nationwide Concealed Carry of Handguns. Because what we're witnessing now is an immense transfer of wealth. Our authority, our sovereignty, maybe somewhere down the line our money, but our greatest wealth is our liberty. And that is being taken away by agencies who want to cultivate increased dependency. And as soon as we surrender our independence, because that's the only coin of the realm they'll take. They want our independence, they want our spirit, They want our resolve. They want us to turn it in. And they use crime as a device to talk us out of it. That's why it's called transfer of wealth. And that's available at Amazon.com or Barnes & Noble.
Well, it's an excellent book. We recommend it. Well, if you're out there in the listening audience, you have a question or comment, our telephone number, 1-888-24-LIBERTY. 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. And you know, if you study history, you'll find out that before there is a genocide, they always confiscate the weapons from the people. They did that to the Armenians there before the First World War. And then you remember what happened to the Armenians after the First World War when almost half the population was slaughtered. Certainly they did it in Hitler's Germany and Stalin's Russia and Mao's China. They did this in Rwanda. They collected the weapons and then they systematically hacked 800,000 Christians to death. An armed population can defend itself. A disarmed population has no way to defend itself. So why are there certain people like Dianne Feinstein and Rosie O'Donnell and so many of the people within the Democrat Party want to disarm the people? Because they want all power to themselves. And I really feel that there are people who really want a dictatorship in America. Certainly, Adolf Hitler understood this, and you're saying, are you equating these people with Adolf Hitler? And I'm saying absolutely, because, you see, we have a constitution, and these legislators have sworn to uphold that constitution and defend it against all enemies, foreign and domestic. And we have people sitting in a United States Senate, sitting in our Congress, sitting in our state legislatures, yes, and sometimes even sitting in the White House, who do not believe in our Constitution. Well, let's go to Will, who's calling us from Missouri. Hi, Will. Did you have a question or comment for our guest?
I have a question and a comment for John Longnecker, which is, you've got a brilliant guest this evening,
well,
and I've really enjoyed
thanks,
this.
Will.
I've really enjoyed this broadcast because it is taking the... It's really taken the issue at the level that I believe that it needs to be taken. John, in your research, in mine, I start with the dictionary, and I like to go back as far as I can. But if you begin with Webster's dictionary and come forward, Webster's 1828 and come forward, and or take old encyclopedias and come forward, there was a shift in the 60s in regards to the word arms that is no longer in the dialogue today. Up until the 1960s, arms was a wide embracing topic that would go all the way up to howitzers or 50 caliber machine guns or mortars or anything. And then in the same category, it was always broken out a subheading called small arms, which is where you would get into hunting and rifles and handguns. But this concept of having the authority, we have the authority through the Constitution, and we have the legal force. The legal force, in my mind, that the founders were thinking of is that if Britain was able to hang sheets of steel on the sides of their vessels, then we could hang sheets of steel on ours. If they were to come after the guys with cannon, then we could field cannon against them and so on. And so this idea of being able to bring arms to bear to back up our citizens' authority is excellent. I look forward to getting your book. But have you ever gone into that word study?
Well, yes, I have. When I was researching the clause that said, shall not be infringed, militia and all the other words of art that were written at a time when they meant words of art. Words of art are what they call legal terms when they have legal meaning. And militia, as it is defined in the United States Code, applies to civilians. We found that out. That's the easiest thing to demonstrate. Words like arms, even though they may evolve, can't really harm us too much because it goes back to original intent. And this is why the Constitution cannot be regarded as a living document. Original intent is everything when we interpret the Constitution, what they really meant. What we know is that they revolted against the crown because of abuse of the law. And they wrote the Constitution to forbid abuse of the law in any age, in any time, because they didn't fear weapons. They didn't write about weapons of the time or of the future, because the Second Amendment doesn't apply to weapons per se. They didn't believe that weapons or arms were a threat to a society. The fear that they had, the thing they perceived as a threat to a society, was abuse of the law. And that's why they say militia, which applies to you and me, and the law does not apply to us. The law applies to government. When it says, shall not be infringed, because they knew, centuries later, somebody's going to try to change the law or use the law, such as with violent crime, to disarm folks, and they will lose the nation.
Amen.
That can't be allowed.
Amen to that. That's very well said. Anything else you want to say, Will, before we let you go?
Absolutely beautiful argument. I look forward to getting the book. Thank you, Dr. Stan.
Hey, Will. Thank you very much. Liberty, Will.
God bless. Now let's go to Frank calling from West Virginia again. Our telephone number, 1-888-24-LIBERTY, 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or 464-8295. Go ahead, Frank.
Hello. I appreciate your guest. I appreciate your topic this evening. I want to speak concerning and ask you a question concerning just basic self-defense. No matter who the bad guy is, whether it's a single breaking and entering in the middle of the night in your home, or whether it be a bunch of organized goons that are a part of a large cabal. Now, with that, we know that through history, the typical has been violence. Even our Lord Jesus Christ told his disciples to sell something you need, you know, your very outer garment, to buy something you need even more, which would be a sword at the time.
That's right.
With that, I was examining the scriptures and trying to find out, okay, is that good enough? Certainly what our Lord tells us is good enough, obviously, but on face value, did he just mean a particular weapon? Because I go to shows once in a while, gun shows, and talk to different gun owners. Be honest with you, there's a big difference, I think, in what I've read in history and our common gun owners of today.
Did you have a question at all, Frank?
Yes, sir. What do you believe about the training to go with the weapons? I've been training in martial arts for 30 years and haven't seen too many even gun owners that have actually take them out of the closet, but once a year maybe to go hunting or to side them in, and the way it has been historically in history around the world.
All right. Do you want to take that one on there, John?
Sure. You know, in martial arts, you have to get very close to your opponent. If you have sticks in Eskrima, or if you have nunchucks in karate, or if you have shuriken in any of the Japanese martial arts, you basically are increasing your reach. You're increasing the distance so that you don't have to be exposed to your opponent, who may be quite lethal. So we extend our reach with all kinds of weapons. This has been the goal of war since time immemorial. And many police officers have developed the concept of the 21-foot rule.
Mm-hmm.
The idea is that when we grapple, like Gracie, or if we do any of the martial arts, our goal is not to kill. Our goal is to stop. Right?
It probably depends on the combat.
Your escalation of force,
yes,
and your ladder of force, mm-hmm, you've got legal considerations that you've got to have the presence of mind of.
Oh, yes, absolutely.
So there's a lot to think about. So you don't really respond and grapple to kill. You want to immobilize and stop him and maybe hold him. Well, the same thing's true with guns. A, you're increasing your reach from a position of safety. You don't have shoot-to-kill orders. And a trained person who is trained in the tactical as well as steering the doggone thing understands that he, too, is not to shoot-to-kill, but only to stop. And only if he believes that he is in reasonable apprehension of grave danger.
Yes,
ladder of force there too. So there are certain analogs to the martial arts. But one of the greatest things is that you have the superior force, and that works very well with more than one aggressor. It works very well when you have a presumption of intent, because you have to act reasonably. and it also provides you with some degree of evidence, which may not be available if we're talking about a martial arts situation, which you may have to legally defend later. The circumstances are better preserved in a gun situation, because you can hold them for police, for instance, or even if the situation has to deteriorate. I prefer the distance that a gun gives me. I'm trained in how to use it, and I will use it if necessary.
All right, fine. Thanks very much for calling, Frank. And let me play the devil's advocate. Well, why would anybody want to have a machine gun? Do you think that people ought to have a right to have a machine gun? I'm playing the devil's advocate here, but I'd like to get your response to that.
Okay. You know, that's pretty easy because, as I mentioned earlier in Part A, the founders didn't view the type of weapon as a problem for the new nation. They were thinking more along the lines of abuse of due process. The second thing is the machine guns are very expensive. Howitzers are difficult to keep gleaming shiny. And any ownership, at least as far as I'm able to determine in some states where they have permits or a tag that you can acquire for the ownership of certain weapons, many of these are very self-limiting. And not everybody on the block is going to have a howitzer or a machine gun. They're going to have something that performs tactically much better for its intended purpose. So with self-limiting, the cost-limiting, I don't think it's going to be a problem. And finally, the most important thing in a free country is that you and I don't have to show cause for anything, Doctor.
And I think, of course, the other thing is that, you know, what they're doing when they ask that question is, you know, they are simply trying to get you away from the basic issue. And the response, one response would be, do you believe in the Second Amendment of the Constitution? Do you believe that the people have the right to keep and bear arms? So why are you bringing up this issue of the machine gun? I mean, what you're trying to do is get us off the main issue, and that is the Constitution gives us the right to have a machine gun or a howitzer, whatever we want to have, as long as we use it and we do not harm others with it. And of course, all this is to take us off of what the major issue is, and that is what the Constitution does to guarantee us as free citizens the right to defend ourselves.
That's right. You know, we don't have to show cause when we want to operate more than one radio station or more than one television station or newspaper. We don't have to show cause, and the First Amendment is not absolute like the Second is. You know, there's another absolute clause in the Constitution, too. That's the ownership and trading of other human beings. You know that when it comes to regulation, some people think that there is such a thing as sensible gun laws or sensible regulation. The idea being that, well, we're not going to really infringe. That's kind of up to the trier of fact. We just want to regulate for safety of the community. But what they're really doing is disarming the good people of the community because they don't understand that the Second Amendment is absolute. The argument is there are two absolutes in the Constitution. One is that your right to your self-defense and your choice of weapons shall not be infringed, and the other is you can't own another human being in this country, not even a little. So you can't regulate it and introduce it with some regulation. You can't even introduce it at all and still adhere to your oath of office.
Amen to that. Well, let's go to Roger calling from Allentown. Roger, you have a question for our guest?
Hi, Roger. Yeah, thanks, gentlemen. I'd like to ask, of course, I don't have any reason to fear my neighbor who has a 50 caliber bazooka. I mean, he didn't get to that position through 20 years of shooting up the neighborhood. But I'd like to ask if you yourself or in other literature, et cetera, anything about, it seems we have an increasingly technologically sophisticated potential for tyranny, and anything on the need for the citizens to have a escalating match of weaponry to defend against an escalating government tyrannical capability.
Now, do you have a question, Roger?
Yeah, I hope you guessed that.
No, I couldn't follow you at all. So, do you have a question?
Well, the need for the citizenry to escalate its store of weaponry to match that held by our governments for too long.
Are you talking about Are you talking about the supersonic...
He's talking about the government has automatic weapons, and they have tear gas grenades and stun grenades. And, of course, we are militarizing our military at the present time. And of course, we have our SWAT teams, certainly with our flak jackets. Basically, they're equipping our police forces as if they were military forces.
The militarization of law enforcement.
Right.
Yeah, I'm not too worried about it because, like the Founding Fathers, I'm not worried about the technology of the weapons. I'm worried about the abuse of due process.
Right.
That's what worries me. I don't care if they're back with snub-nosed revolvers. I don't care if they're back with street sweepers. I think that when they begin to take authority and assume powers we did not grant them, that's the fear.
Now we're into that. And again, your webpage?
Goodforthecountry.com.
And, of course, your... Name of your book.
Transfer of Wealth, The Case for Nationwide Concealed Carry of Handguns.
Well, thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
And let's go to Jack calling from Michigan. Do you have a question for our guest?
Real quick. November 91, the American Rifleman magazine featured the executive director who reviewed the U.S. Code citations on militias, and he identified the organized and the unorganized militia, that being people like us in the unorganized, and then he specifically cited U.S. Code provisions for civilian marksmanship training, i.e., the government was to endow certain monies to train civilians in marksmanship.
Right.
Whatever happened to that?
All right. Do you have any thoughts on that at all?
Well, you know, every time somebody cites a particular authority in the law, you know, someplace there's one that amplifies it or modifies it or negates it. And what happened to the money? You know, if I could find out what happened to the authorizations and then the funding that was supposed to support them, then I guess I'd run for office. You know, when we talk about follow-through this way, we need to understand that if there's something we believe we need as a safeguard for our values and our way of life in this country, we're going to have to get involved. And if we can't get involved in the White House, because we're not the ones who are running for office, we can get involved in the issues. And one of the things that I really wish we would hear, such as the militia issue, such as the funding, would be, dear Mr. or Madam Senator, where do you stand on concealed carry of handguns as a national bill? Where do you stand on self-defense when it comes to meeting violent crime that's consuming the country? Would you please elaborate? And put them on the spot. And I mean on talk radio. I mean on the debates. I mean every single media opportunity.
And you know, one of the things we ought to do is emphasize, do you believe in the Constitution? If you don't believe in the Constitution and you think this is not proper, then why don't you try to change the Constitution? Why don't you try to amend it? Why do you want to use your opinion to override the Constitution which you've sworn to uphold?
Well, part of the problem is that they believe that when they take the oath of office, they have some kind of latitude in interpreting what amounts to the defense of the Constitution and adherence to it. They think they have wiggle room. They think it's subject to interpretation. That's where they go wrong.
Yeah, they don't. They become enemies of the Constitution. They're sworn to uphold. John Longnecker, thank you very much. Great program.
Thank you so much, Dr. Stan.
Well, this is Dr. Stan. I hope you enjoyed the program, and I think it's a very, very important program. You need to understand this effort to disarm our population. You need, of course, to get some of the program, some of the four tapes. Since we have a four tape set on the other Holocaust, of course, we have a four tape set on what really happened in the Holocaust too. But when you have a disarmed population, you have no defense against government. And I think the other Holocaust is an excellent four-tape set. And that what really happened in the Holocaust is important. We have, of course, certainly information going into the background of this effort to disarm the population, and you can get these items by calling 1-800-544-8927. 1-800-544-8927. If you'd like to get a copy of our interview with John Longnecker, I think he's done a great job. He's thought this through very well. And remember, the police are under no obligation to come to protect you. You need to be able to protect yourself. We'll understand, of course, that behind everything going on today are powerful spiritual forces. And if you have not yet read my book, Brotherhood of Darkness, or watched our DVD, Brotherhood of Darkness, you need to get it. You need to get a DVD and or VHS on the Forbidden Secret and get the syllabus that goes with that, so that you'll come to understand about the angel who rides in the whirlwind and directs this storm. You'll begin to understand what President Bush meant when he talked about what our founders declared a new order of the ages. They were acting on an ancient hope that is meant to be fulfilled. What was he talking about? I mean, what's this new order of the ages? What's this ancient hope that's meant to be fulfilled? That came from the closing remarks in his second inaugural speech. And we want you to read those inaugural speeches. We want you to understand what he's referring to when he talks about the fire in the hearts of men. And the fact that there really are people who have a different worldview and want to create a one-world government, a one-world religion, and a new world leader. You need, of course, to get the videos, the secret mysteries of America's beginnings. Riddles in Stone, the history of our nation's capital. You need to get Chris Pinto's DVD that Talkie gave at our last conference on the Atlantis Connection. Constance Cumby, The Emergence, or their four-tape set with Constance Cumby, who studied the New Age and occult movement for many years. You need to get our information on Masonry, on the books we have on Masonry. You need to understand why the Supreme Court took God and prayer out of our schools, and that's covered in my book, Brotherhood of Darkness. It's because the Masons control the United States Supreme Court in majorities of 5-4 to 8-1 between 1941 and 1971, and it was during those years they took God and prayer out of our schools and began to centralize power in Washington, D.C., and change our immigration laws, and, of course, begin to bring about the Great Society and all of these unconstitutional socialist programs as we move from freedom to fascism. And there really is a planned program, and there really are secret societies, and you need to get our four-tape set on Skull and Bones and the books we have. You need to get our four-tape set on the Bohemian Grove and the wonderful video that Alex Jones put out entitled The Secret Mysteries of the Bohemian Grove. Go to our website at RadioLiberty.com. That's RadioLiberty.com. Get the items that are available from Radio Liberty by calling 1-800-544-8927. Learn how to obtain these. If you'd like to get copies of tonight's program or other programs, give us a call at 1-800-544-8927 and then pray for America. Pray for revival, but please pray for Radio Liberty, for our provision and our protection. We'll be right back. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality and not illusion or delusion that'll determine what the future will bring. And I need to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views and, well, the views of our guest. And for this next hour, our guest is William Grigg, who's certainly one of the most articulate guests we have on Radio Liberty, and we're pleased to be able to bring his views to you. For many years, he was a senior editor of the New American magazine, and now, of course, he's working to educate people. He's writing books. He does a regular radio program on the Genesis Network once a week, and hopefully he'll be with us here on Radio Liberty to bring you his commentary on what is transpiring. Because, ladies and gentlemen, we are living at a crossroads in history, a watershed time when we will very soon determine whether America will survive as a free nation or simply become part of the ashpit of history. So, with that as the background, William, what are we going to talk on this evening?
Well, Dr. Stan, I think that within the last week or so, we've had a couple of really important illustrations of just how vulnerable our economy is. You're probably aware of the on-screen, live on-the-air meltdown by Jim Cramer on CNBC about a week ago. Jim Cramer is a theatrically histrionic Wall Street stock picker who has a program called Mad Money that's been flogged by Glenn Beck and some other people in the talk radio realm. And he's somebody who emits this dense cloud of opaque buzzwords and catchphrases about the economy and the stock market, and his stock picks have been erratically useful. There's a really interesting online website that compares his performance as a stock picker with picks that are apparently made at random by a chimpanzee, and apparently it's a matter of 6 and 5 and pick 'em as to which of those two you'll look to for stock market advice. But last Friday, he had a full-fledged aneurysm-threatening meltdown on the air talking about what's going on with the subprime mortgage crisis and the fact that, as he put it, somebody rich like himself really can't even get out and go out and get a loan right now in the current market environment. And he was urging Ben Bernanke, helicopter Ben Bernanke, the current commissar of the Federal Reserve, to open the discount window. And that's an Aesopian bit of language that only people who are familiar with the mysteries of the temple called the Federal Reserve would understand. Well, the discount window is a reference to the Federal Reserve loosening the money supply, emitting another stream of money and credit, either in the form of these artlessly disfigured pieces of rag paper that we call dollars, or the digital equivalent, as a way of loosening up the money supply so that money can be lent and speculators can continue to throw money into the stock market and somehow earn a living through this bizarre alchemy that they practice whereby debt somehow becomes profit for certain people. But the Federal Reserve, for whatever reason, is not really at this point eager to loosen up the money supply. And a few days later, we heard the representatives of the government in Beijing talking about how they are at the point now where, weary of criticism from Washington and threats from the Congress to impose trade sanctions that would require China to revalue its currency, the Chinese have said that they're at the point where they might start dumping their dollar-denominated assets, treasury notes and other financial instruments that are basically being purchased by China at the rate of, I think, billions of dollars a day in order to keep our economy afloat. Now, they know, the Chinese, being many things, but stupid not is not on that list, they know that they have the leverage over Washington right now where they can pretty much dictate to Washington.
Hold that thought. We'll be right back here in just a moment. All right, go right ahead.
Yeah, as I was saying, the Chinese know that they can dictate many things to Washington, or at least if not dictate, have pretty much decisive behind-the-scenes covert influence on certain decisions that are being made, because they have this so-called nuclear option being a metaphorical expression. I mean, they're not talking necessarily about China literally launching a nuclear attack on the United States, at least not yet. They don't have first strike capacity yet. But in the metaphorical realm, the sell-off of their dollar holdings, their foreign exchange holdings denominated in dollars, would wreck all kinds of devastation and havoc upon our economy and be in many ways as devastating as a nuclear attack, a literal nuclear attack might be. And I think it's really interesting that just in the last couple of days we've seen a threatened, what looked to me like an abortive bank run on one of the largest banks in Europe over in France. They had to close down a little bit. I'm trying to remember the exact circumstances, but this all has to do with the washout, I think, of the subprime market, and that has radiating consequences because we have been exporting our inflation in the form of foreign governments doing what they can to keep the dollar propped up, and the European bank in question, the French bank, was one of the largest banks in the continent. It's called BNP Paribas. And according to a Reuters report from a couple of days ago, it said France's biggest publicly traded bank froze withdrawals from 1.6 billion euros, which is roughly $2.2 billion, worth of funds as problems with risky U.S. subprime mortgages and diminishing liquidity prevented it from calculating their value. So they're really getting caught right now in a bind because they don't know exactly how much these mortgages are worth. They don't really know what's going on with the value of these loans and the instruments that are being generated on the basis of these loans, so they froze withdrawals. Not only because they didn't know what the accounting would look like, but I suspect that there are people who tried to bail out right now, and they wanted to prevent this until something happened to stabilize the banking system in Europe, and sure enough, the European Central Bank, which is the European Union's equivalent of the Federal Reserve, pumped 94.8 billion euros of what's called emergency liquidity into Europe's money markets. That means that they just generated by, I would imagine, the click of a mouse through computer networks, they just generated the equivalent of $130 billion of, throwing around money.
Hold that thought. We'll be right back in just a moment. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and William Grigg is certainly talking about the things that we should all be concerned about. First of all, the communist Chinese government has actually threatened the nuclear option. Now, they're not talking about nuclear weapons. They're talking about beginning to sell off their $1.3 to $1.4 trillion of reserves, most of which are in American dollars. And if they were to dump the $800 billion that they have of American dollars on the open market, it would crash our currency and crash our stock market and destroy the value of the life savings of every American listening to this program, and it would all disappear literally overnight. And then, of course, William is talking about what's going on in Europe, where one of France's largest banks, of course, has shut it down because they'd bought so many of these collateralized debt obligations, and they didn't know whether they really had any value at all. These
exactly.
are the mortgages. And, of course, to counter that, the European Central Bank had dumped something like 100, 130 billion euros or dollars into the market there. Highly inflationary. I mean, Europe has been doing everything they could to avoid inflation, and yet faced with the situation we have today, there's only two options: either let the whole system collapse or to inflate like mad and end up like Rhodesia. But go ahead.
Yeah, that's a very good point. I mean, right now, Zimbabwe, the former Rhodesia, is suffering a world historic bout of hyperinflation because they have a thoroughly Marxist government that simply cannot permit anybody to create any wealth. And so they do what governments in that situation always do, which is they inflate the currency and use that to steal the wealth of the public, the wealth of the productive classes. And you made reference to the fact that the savings of Americans would be destroyed by the hyperinflation that would result. if it became necessary to buy back the dollar-denominated bonds from China, if they were to put them up and call in their loans, so to speak, from the United States. The thing is, we don't really have savings in this country. We're since the last, I believe, the last 18 months, for the first time since the era of the Great Depression, we're a country that has a net negative savings rate.
As you explain what that is to our listeners, because I don't think they understand what a net negative savings rate is.
Yeah, that means that not only do people not have savings accounts or usable equity in that sense, if we were to look at the national economy as a single household, we would have a household that was deeply in debt rather than having some kind of assets above the debt line. Most people 30, 40, 50 years ago, rather than carrying a huge amount of consumer debt in the form of credit cards and rotating loans and debts of this sort, they had savings accounts. They had savings accounts and checking accounts. Usually what would happen is that over the course of 20 or 30 years of active labor, they would put away something with every paycheck. They would take out a mortgage. They would pay off the mortgage in, say, 20 years. Then after the mortgage was paid off, they would have automobiles that were completely paid off. They might have charge cards that would pay off after every month. But the point is, they would have a savings account, which means that they would have a net positive savings rate. Whereas today, people usually have 5, 10, 15, or more types of consumer debt, whether you're talking about credit cards, which are just the most perfect form of fraud ever devised by man, or whether you're talking about revolving accounts with various retail stores, or whether you're talking about automobile loans that have not been paid off, whether you're talking about first or second or third mortgages. The point is, they don't have any savings, but they have all of these debts, which means that they have net negative savings rates. And as a single household, taking the economy as a single household, that's where we are as a country right now. We do not have savings from which the federal government can borrow. It has to go into capital markets and borrow money for operating expenses. And so it has to do something else. And what it's been doing historically is one of two things, or both of these things together. Either it will contact the Federal Reserve and ask them to take out their magic checkbook, as Ed Griffin puts it, and simply create the amount of so-called money necessary to cover government's operating expenses, or they will seek to borrow money by having people overseas, such as the Chinese, the Japanese, the Saudis, and others of that sort, buy treasury bonds, which are pretty much the same kind of thing, or some combination of the two. And it becomes really a very imponderable process, you know, for mortal minds like yours and mine, Dr. Stant, to wrap themselves around the machinations whereby these people do what they do. Is a really difficult task, because we're used to balancing our checkbooks and living within our means. We don't have the luxury of going out and simply conjuring out of thin air an instrument of debt that somebody has to accept as if it were money, the way that the federal government operates, the way that the other central banks operate as well. And of course, they're all part of the same system. When you saw the European Central Bank leap into action this week to create this liquidity, they did the equivalent of what Jim Cramer was talking about when he was yelling at Bernanke to open the discount window. He was asking Bernanke to do at the Federal Reserve what the European Central Bank just did, which is to create this huge volume of so-called money to inject liquidity into the investment markets to keep them running. And the bank in Canada, the Central Bank of Canada, did the same thing. And these are all, I believe, efforts to prop up the system, to keep the dollar afloat. And I think that they were all triggered by these two developments, the accelerating collapse of the subprime mortgage market, which is, once again, pretty much the tentpole upon which depends the entire consumer economy of the United States, is the housing and mortgage market, and then China's threat to start dumping its dollar reserves.
I think one of the other very interesting things is, William, is the fact that a number of countries, China among them, Russia, India, several other countries, have formed these sovereign wealth concerns. Go ahead and pick up that story, because this suggests to me that the major central banks of the world are going to begin, and they've just announced it the last 2 weeks, 3 weeks, to divest themselves of dollars, which means the end of the position of the dollar as the reserve currency of the world. That will have disastrous effects on everyone listening to this program.
Yeah. Well, just to take that part of the story and address it first in a way that I think is most tangibly obvious to your common American. If the dollar collapses, which is what would happen if the sell-off of Chinese assets and other assets held, dollar-denominated assets held by foreign governments were to occur, the fact that we are dependent on imports for practically everything we buy would become very painfully obvious in a hurry. If we go to, say, Walmart or any of the other big-box retailers that are in the business of repackaging goods which are shipped here primarily from China but also from other countries abroad, primarily in Asia, the collapse of the dollar would have immediate consequences. That which you purchase, that shirt that you bought today at Walmart for $6, a couple of days from now might cost $75 or $80, for instance. Just one really obvious example of that. You know, you're talking about a Weimar-type exponential parabolic curve in terms of the consumer prices we'd have to pay. That's what could happen in very short order if the Chinese make good on that threat. You talked about the sovereign wealth funds, which are being created by a number. Actually, they have been, some of them have been in existence for decades, but very quietly doing what they have done. A sovereign wealth fund basically is an investment company run by a national government. And what it does is that it uses the foreign exchange reserves, which are accumulated through commerce with a given country or group of countries, as a capital pool to go out and buy assets on behalf of that national government. Sometimes this is relatively benign. I don't think that it's really benign in an ultimate sense, because you're talking, of course, about socialism here, when a government is using money as an investment mechanism to buy things, nationalizing assets. I don't think that that's benign at all. But when the government of Norway is doing things of this sort, it's a little less alarming than when the government of China does such things. As you mentioned, China has between, $1.3 and maybe $1.5 trillion in its foreign exchange reserves. That's the amount of money it could use to buy up every company that is traded on the Dow Jones, for instance. Just last week we heard that in order to rebuild the infrastructure, the roads and bridges, sewer systems, water systems, and similar assets in this country, to refurbish them, to make them up to spec, so to speak, would cost about that same amount of money. So, China could decide it wants to buy our infrastructure, buy up our highway system. China could pay the entire cost. As a matter of fact, you make a very good case that through the purchase of treasury instruments, China has been paying the cost of the war in Iraq, which have been calculated to be roughly $1.6 trillion if we were to withdraw very quickly. And so that's the amount, not far in excess of what China's foreign exchange reserves are. The point I'm making is that China has the capacity through a sovereign wealth fund to use this foreign exchange to do all kinds of things that would amount to a buyout of various American interests and various American assets. Saudi Arabia, of course, as is the case with most of the oil-producing countries, has a nationalized oil production system. Oil production, by the way, around the world is almost entirely controlled by national governments. That's a really interesting thing that not many people appreciate, is that oil is a socialized commodity, which is why it costs so much. But as is the case with most of the oil-producing countries, Saudi Arabia has a sovereign wealth fund, so does Qatar, so do a number of the other Persian Gulf states, Emirates, and so forth. The United Arab Emirates, through a sovereign wealth fund, was trying to buy its way into the pork business about a year ago, and that attracted a lot of attention. And that's typical of the things we're going to see now, because we're at a point in our nation's history where the dollar itself doesn't really
represent a store of value. People are going to want to take these dollars they've been getting from Washington and use them to buy things that have palpable value, whether you're talking about oil or precious metals or commodities or infrastructure.
And, of course, as those dollars are set upon our economy, they could be tremendously inflationary.
Exactly.
Well, you go right ahead and pick up the story there.
Well, with respect to what's going on in the realm of inflation and the historic impact that that has had on countries and societies, it's always a good idea to take a look at the way that the middle class has been absolutely immolated in the flames of hyperinflation's past. You take a look at what happened, for instance, in revolutionary Russia. They had a hyperinflation that occurred in 1921, 1922 through the Lenin's new economic policy, where they were nationalizing a lot of the what existed by way of industry and infrastructure in Russia. And then a few years later, he had hyperinflation in Germany, which is one that everybody remembers, you know, the spectacle of people taking potato sacks full of Reichmarks or wheelbarrows full of the same currency in order to make grocery purchases because prices were changing so quickly, often not only hourly, but within 10 or 15 minutes of being posted. They didn't know how much a given commodity was going to cost, and so they had to empty out their bank accounts and wheel these large commodities, or large quantities of currency into their grocers in order to buy bread and milk and potatoes and such like. And I've actually seen some of the German currency of the era where, as I've mentioned before, I believe, you only had to print it on one side because it had to be leave the printing office so quickly they didn't have time to print both sides of the bills. Because if they did that, their value would depreciate to the point where the bill would literally be obsolete by the time it left the printing press. I don't know if we're headed for that type of a meltdown, but it's certainly conceivable if you see China dump its dollar assets and Washington decide that the only way out of this impasse is effectively to repudiate that debt by monetizing it, meaning to let the printing presses or the digital equivalent rip and simply create a sufficient volume of so-called dollars that you can pay off these static sums of money with rapidly depreciating dollars. And the government would get the first best use of this inflated currency. It always does. And by the time it gets to us, everything that we would have to buy by way of necessity would be priced almost beyond our reach. And that's already happening, by the way. The fraud of the way that consumer inflation is calculated right now is one of the great deceptions of our time, where we're told that you can calculate core inflation without taking into account things we cannot live without, such as, well, food and energy. You know, the two things that everybody needs to survive are usually left out of the calculations of the core inflation rate. And the result is that people get a downright Panglossian view of how the economy is doing, because we're told that inflation is remaining relatively stable at a very low rate, when in fact, if you calculate the amount that we're paying for the basic necessities, the indispensable items that we require, which are food and energy, inflation is measured in terms of what we're paying has been meteorically rising over the last several years, and it's not going to get any better.
Well, I share your concerns, and I think everybody should begin to understand that we could be on the edge of simply a runaway inflation, and everything seems to point to the fact that we're going to see very real economic problems in this country. We're shipping our manufacturing overseas, we're shipping our jobs overseas, and we're dependent upon those goods coming in from other countries. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest is William Grigg. Why don't you pick the story up there, William?
Well, I just wanted to throw something out for discussion and see if you've given any thought to this, Dr. Stan, but what do you think is the possibility, if any, of a revival of an old and very disreputable institution called the debtor's prison? I think that we actually have forms of that type of incarceration that we can recognize today. For instance, if you take a look at the way that some of the traffic laws are being used now as revenue measures. There's a wonderful resource on the internet called thenewspaper.com, which is a website devoted entirely to what it calls the politics of driving. I discovered this about a year and a half ago, and I check it obsessively every day now, because it's just amazing the amount of really ugly things that are happening in the realm of traffic regulation. Of course, the great American freedom is the freedom of the open road. You know, the automobile being invented in this country, and the way that people have an attachment to the idea of mobility is something distinctively American, and has been since at least the jazz age of the 1920s, when suddenly there was a roadster at every house, it seemed. And if you take a look at what happened recently in Virginia, there was a measure that went through that would impose these extortionate traffic fines of thousands of dollars for relatively minor speeding infractions. And the way that you find people losing their automobiles that are confiscated at checkpoints and at DUI and seatbelt inspection points and things of that sort, it just seems to me that there are various ways that are being pursued by the powers that be to get people into a position where they're put into a terrible dilemma. Do I drive to work, or now that I'm hit with these traffic fines, these traffic citations, I can't afford to pay them, my license has been suspended, do I run the risk of going to jail? Here in Idaho, until very recently, I think the last couple of years, it was possible, if you were caught twice driving with a suspended license, to go to prison here. And usually that would happen because people couldn't afford to pay the fines of several hundreds of dollars, and they couldn't afford not to drive and go to work. And I think that's just one illustration of the way that the system has been rigged in such fashion that people end up going to jail simply and for the simple and exclusive reason that they cannot pay these fines because of their financial situation.
Well, of course, I think one of the things is that the governments are having more and more trouble of raising their the revenue they need. After all, government is like a hungry lion. It just never has enough to eat. And so the communities, whether it be the county, whether it be the city, whether it be the state, needs additional sources of income. What better source than the traffic fines? I read someplace they were charging people something like $700 for a speeding ticket. If you went over 20 miles an hour over the speed limit, $700 for the fine. But it was being used to collect money.
Yeah.
They're putting up, of course, the videos at the various intersections to catch people going through red lights. And it's being used primarily not to protect the people, but to raise money. And I think this is a very, very dangerous concept. And now, of course, the other thing that bothers me is that they have changed the bankruptcy laws, so you can't readily go bankrupt. They have, of course, cheated many of our students. They thought they were getting fair loans. They were being encouraged by their schools to take out loans with 8, 9, 10, 11% interest. I mean, interest that they could never hope to pay off. And many of our students start their life after they graduate from college with massive loans. And suddenly the government, which is really the culprit here, is saying, oh, isn't that a terrible shame? Well, we're going to pass a law. We're going to just begin to do something to try to help these students. And yet it was their policies that brought it about. The universities, corrupted as they are, were steering the students into these loan sharks, and they truly were loan sharks.
Oh, yeah.
Extracting a pound of flesh from our students. And so many of our students began life with actually 2.5 strikes against them and very little hope of ever getting out of debt. But we're going to be back here in just a moment or two with William Grigg as we begin looking at what's happening to America financially. Increasingly, people with college degrees, engineering degrees, they can't get jobs. If they do have a job, why, they're being replaced with somebody from India who will work at half the price. This is what's going on over in Silicon Valley today. Mm-hmm. And we hear this story over and over again. People losing their jobs to people from other countries who work for half the price. And this is exactly what is planned. If you haven't read the Earth Charter, you need to get it, you need to read it. Nothing is happening by accident. It's all according to a grand plan. But of course, Rush Limbaugh is not going to tell you about that plan. This is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, so William, why don't you go ahead and just take it on from there.
It's interesting to bring up the student loan issue, because in my most recent book, not the one that I've just finished and that's in post-production, as it were, right now, which is called Liberty and Eclipse, The Rise of the Homeland Security State, but the book before that, which was called America's Engineered Decline, I talk about the way that students begin their lives, graduating college students, begin their lives as debtors, and often with debt burden that most people, say 30 or 40 years ago, simply couldn't have conceived. First of all, it's in college that most young people are introduced to credit cards. When I went to Utah State University, this wasn't that long ago, this was maybe 20 years ago, when it was almost exactly 20 years ago, as a matter of fact, I noticed that there was a real push to get us to sign up for credit cards. This was in 1986, 1987, when we noticed that these people were prowling the halls of the Taggart Student Center there in Logan with their credit card applications. I thought that was frankly bizarre, because at the time I had very little money in the bank. I was working a part-time job, and I wasn't really interested in getting a credit card. And it was a very big temptation, because it seems like free money when somebody hands you this magical piece of plastic that allows you to go out and get goods and services. But for somebody who's a college student of very straitened circumstances and limited means, credit card's huge temptation. It's a little like Frodo's ring from the Tolkien novels, where you just cannot quite resist the temptation to get it out and make use of it just this once, because circumstances are so tight. And that's one thing that happens that ends up getting young people mired in debt when they're in college. But the student loan racket, which is one of the biggest and biggest and nastiest rackets of a sort I can think of, is particularly obnoxious, because if you fall behind on the student loan payment, after a certain point, they'll send the marshals after you. They will literally send the U.S. marshals after you, and you can be prosecuted and sent to prison for failing to pay off your federal student loans, which is just an amazing thing. That's literally somebody being imprisoned, incarcerated in debtor's prison, when they send the U.S. Marshal Service after somebody who's defaulted on a student loan. But I suspect that that's just an augury of what's to come. And you made mention of the fact that the state and local governments, county governments, are becoming...
Hold that thought. We'll be right back here with him in just a moment here. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and William was just saying that, you know, there is, in one of his recent books, he mentions that certainly the students who fall behind on the repayment of the student loans, sometimes they will actually send the U.S. Marshals out, of course, to arrest them and put them in prison because they've fallen behind on their loans, and then pick up the story from there, William.
Yep. And I think that this might be a portent of things to come. And I appreciate the fact that you brought up the fact that states and counties and municipal governments are becoming more inventive in ways to make people beholden to them financially, whether you're talking about tax increases, user fees, tolls, traffic tickets, things of that sort. Here in Idaho, in a few communities, for instance, up in the northern part of the state, which is fairly wealthy, and certain other parts of the state that tend to be inhabited by people who occupy a fairly high economic stratum, people have had a really interesting experience where house prices have appreciated dramatically over the last several years, and then about a year and a half, 2 years ago, the bubble burst, house prices, real estate prices started to decline, and they declined, you know, rapidly enough that people found that they had overextended themselves, over-leveraged themselves, and the expected equity hadn't materialized. or they'd lost some of the, I call it sand and equity that they thought that they had. But the thing is, the property taxes kept going up, and because it lagged behind the appreciation, and now these people with depreciating homes are being hit with property taxes that are based on valuations that occurred 18 months, 24 months ago. That's the sort of thing that's happening all across the country, and I think that's something that's helping to drive the mortgage collapse. I think that's one of the ways that it's starting to feed on itself. But another thing that's happening, this is something I've written about in my blog, is the advent of, well, not really the advent, but the expansion of what is called quality of life laws at the state and local level. And in a lot of communities, Atlanta being one I can mention off the top of my head, Cleveland being another, you have huge sections of the cities that had been the scene of a real estate boom as the subprime mortgages were being written a couple of years ago. Jim Cramer said 14 million people between 2005 and 2007 went out as subprime borrowers, invited into the marketplace by the retiring former Federal Reserve Chairman Greenspan to go out and get these mortgage loans at teaser rates that they knew were going to go up, you know, adjustable rate mortgages, or what's, I think the expression that I've used before on this program, were the ninja loans, no income, no job, no assets, but it's okay, you can still get a mortgage loan. But these people got these loans in towns like Cleveland and in Atlanta, and they didn't qualify by any rational reckoning, and they weren't able to make the payments. And so their homes have been repossessed, and they've been foreclosed on. Nobody's living in these homes. They're starting to look like little discarded pieces of real estate. You know, the lawns have gotten overrun. The house is starting to fall apart. And as this happens, home prices, real estate values in the given neighborhood tend to plummet. And so now you have quality of life laws that are being written in some of these communities regarding such things as, you know, how often you trim your grass, how you take care of your trees, how you take care of your dogs and other domestic pets, whether or not you can have a non-functioning automobile on your own property is something that is now becoming more and more of an issue with respect to these municipal ordinances and codes. The way that they're defending this is by saying, well, we have to keep the real estate values up, as if they could do this. You know, as the housing prices collapse nationwide, they're not going to be able to keep the property values up. It's just not going to happen. But that's the rationale. We want to keep the property values up, and so in order to do this, we're going to have more police officers taking proactive measures to enforce these quality of life ordinances, and it's for your own good, obviously, because you have an interest in keeping your property value up. Well, as a result, you have people now being hit with these extortionate tickets because they've not taken care of the trash as fastidiously as the city government would require, or they have a non-functioning automobile on their own property. There was a poor fellow in a suburb of Chicago, Joliet, Illinois, who was thrown face down in the dirt with a boot on the back of his neck and dragged into jail because he had a non-functioning automobile that belonged to his brother, a van, on his own property. And the police officer, who was magnifying his calling, so to speak, decided to make an issue out of this when it could have been taken care of in some other way. There was an incident in Orem, Utah, not long ago, where some woman in her 70s, who couldn't afford to pay the water bill, had grass that was being burned up in the pitiless 100-plus degree July sun, and a police officer materialized on her door and was going to write her a ticket for several hundred dollars, and she said, I'm going to talk to my son and talk to an attorney, and turned away, and the police officer decided she was resisting arrest, and so he threw her face down on the concrete and took her into the jail. This is the sort of thing we're going to see happening. This is going to proliferate, and it's being driven by the fact that municipal governments don't have the option that the federal government has of simply having the Federal Reserve print up money that it can use right away, or what's much the same thing in terms of its ultimate effect, turning to foreign allies to buy their treasury bills. You know, municipal governments have to find some way of conjuring money that involves actually putting the screws to people, using the agents of coercion, these very pleasant people in costumes with tin jewelry and guns, to go out and extract wealth from people, and it's going to get really nasty. It's getting really nasty already.
I share your concern, Chris. This is what happens, really, when the whole infrastructure of a society begins to break down. I fear we're entering a period of chaos and crisis. I think that we're going to see increasing lawlessness, and then there will be a response to that lawlessness.
Yeah.
It has been said, when liberty leads to a loss of order, then the demand for order will lead to a loss of all liberty. And I think this is coming and coming very rapidly, and I think we're going to be seeing a lot of our major communities going bankrupt. Certainly our states have made promises to provide very, very handsome pension benefits for the retired police officers and the firemen and other government employees, obligations that they do not have the money to meet. And so what are they going to do? Well, we know what they've done in New Jersey. They sold off the New Jersey Turnpike so that they could meet their obligations for the first year, but what happens next year?
Yeah.
And the year after that, when there's nothing else to sell off.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that we're going to see many of our municipalities beginning to go bankrupt, and they're not going to have, then what happens to their bonds? What happens to their money, people that they've borrowed money from? And I think we can begin to see the whole infrastructure of American society begin to implode, not only at the local, but at the national level, because there is no way we can possibly pay off all those loans, pardon me, all those obligations we have to fund Medicare and Social Security and federal pensions and veterans and Army pensions. You go right ahead, William.
Yeah, well, that's a very good point, because what we're talking about to this point is simply the huge amount of debt that's been run up because the government that rules us isn't deferring to the constitutional limits on its actions and the extent of its powers. So they have to go outside the constitutional structure of revenue and create debt so that it can do all these things it's not been authorized to do. That's just what they're doing in terms of current operating expenses and priorities, but we're not even talking about the unfunded liabilities that are going to exponentiate beginning in about 2009, 2010, when we see the retirement of the baby boomers, and when that, somebody once described this undigested demographic lump that is the baby boomer generation, to which I belong, by the way. I mean, it lasted what was it, commonly reckoned as being 1945 to 1964. I was born in 1963, so I was sort of at the tail end of the baby boom. But the point is, it's been described as a puppy being digested by a python. You know, you see this big lump going through this really small passageway. And that process is about to terminate in 2009, a couple of years, 2009, 2010.
Well, actually, retirement starts the first of next year in 2008.
That's true.
But that will only be for those who are 62 years of age.
Yeah, exactly.
And they won't be eligible for Medicare. But 3 years after that, in other words, in 2011, then they become eligible not only for full retirement under Social Security, but then they get their Medicare benefits as well.
Which were very thoughtfully, radically expanded by George W. Bush just shortly before the election in 2004 as a cynical re-election ploy. That's an interesting thing that's worthy of just a little bit more in-depth scrutiny, the way that the Republican leadership of the House of Representatives kept that vote open, I believe, for hours. So they could go out and browbeat a number of recalcitrant Republican legislators into supporting this grotesque enrichment. Nobody knows how much it's going to be. Hundreds of billions of dollars at least, but it's probably something in excess of $1 trillion. Bruce Bartlett's book, Imposter, about George W. Bush's phony conservative, has a wonderful chapter, a wonderfully detailed chapter about that outrage. But the point is, they kept this open. They used all kinds of inducements, bribes, threats, cajolings. I don't know the extent to which the bribes were the salient element of the recipe. Who knows? I mean, it was bribes and threats in some ratio. But they finally were able to get enough Republicans on board to sign off on this huge expansion of Medicare. And that, of course, is something that's going to blow up in our faces when the baby boomers retire, become eligible for Medicare in 2011. That alone will be quite enough to sink our economy in the abstract and in the absence of these other factors we're talking about. But it's the sort of thing that really represents a microcosm of our politics over the last several decades, where you had presidential administration eager for re-election and willing to buy re-election at the price of a radical expansion of an entitlement that is probably going to kill our economy in a few years. And as far as George Bush and the adults who write his lines for him are concerned, that was perfectly all right, because after all, it's not as if they're going to be the ones doing the suffering.
I agree with you totally, and I think that we the American people must understand that history tells us over and over again that nations go bankrupt. And if you go back and you read the writings of Cicero, you know, 50 years before Christ was born, and talking about how the budget should be balanced.
Mm-hmm.
We have to balance the budget. Well, of course, nobody wanted to hear that in ancient Rome, but they didn't balance the budget, and very, very shortly, why the Roman Republic ended, and they then established their Roman Empire, the dictatorship. But, you know, you cannot have a free society with a free-spending Senate or a legislature and totally, you know, refusal to balance the budget.
Yeah, you can't do that, because at some point, the government that rules over that system is going to have to engage in brute violence as well as fraud. It has to be fraud backed up by lawless force, because it has to force the people to keep accepting these instruments of debt as opposed to legitimate money as a way of conducting business.
Well, you know, I think here in California is a perfect example.
Yeah.
Arnold Schwarzenegger, of course, you know, is going to balance the budget by going out and borrowing money.
Yeah.
About $40 billion, that's B, billion dollars last year. He wants to borrow another $40 billion either this year or the first of next year. And that is how we're going to get the infrastructure of our state repaired. That's how we're going to keep the economy going. On borrowed money.
Yeah.
But nobody ever asks what happens when you have to pay it back.
Exactly.
You have to pay it back twice as much as you borrowed, and where's the money going to come from?
Oh.
And people say, well, you know, it's not as if it's going to cost us anything, we're simply going to borrow it. And you know, what really bothers me, William, is that so many good people voted for that legislation last time around, and one of these days, we're going to have to simply forego all of those loans. We're going to have to simply renounce those loans. And you think that there's economic trouble now. States all across America are going to begin to go back on their loans. And you think that the CDO crisis was big. You just wait till the federal government and our states and the municipalities begin renouncing their loans. And the whole infrastructure of the world capitalist system collapses.
Well, that's one of the reasons why this issue of the sovereign wealth funds is so provocative to me, because when you're talking about California, California is a huge prize for anybody. Granted, California is also a petri dish for every variety of nutcase utopianism one can imagine, and quite a few varieties that are beyond the imagination of normal, rational people. And, of course, it has a government which is run quite a bit like any other third world country you can imagine. I think it would be, what, the world's fourth or fifth largest economy? Am I exaggerating?
The sixth largest economy,
okay. If it were an independent nation state. Hugely resource rich. It's always been a huge prize. If you're, say, the government of communist China, and you're aware of the fact that California is having all kinds of social turmoil and economic problems, and that the government of that state is deeply in debt, that Washington's not going to be in a position to bail out California when those loans come due. What do? If you're the Chinese, you make yourself very helpful, and it seems to me that you're probably going to see a lot of overt state oriented investments by China in various elements of California's infrastructure. Nobody wants to pay for infrastructure. you want, I mean, you take a look at the way that it's been managed since the National Highway System went online in 1956. They started building it, and they created a trust fund for the putative purpose of maintaining the highways in the United States. The trust fund has been used as a slush fund for every parasitic political constituency and every corrupt, usually organized crime-linked organized labor group that's been involved in these enterprises. It's done everything in the world except provide for the actual upkeep and maintenance of the national highway system, which is why you have bridges falling apart in places like Minnesota. And, of course, the same thing is true of the states. And I think that California is going to be a very attractive prize once China looks for a place to invest some of its money, should it seek to do so.
Before we go on here, I want you to get your webpage out and how people can get your books and your other information.
All right. The best place to go to read my material is rightsourceonline.com. That's the homepage for the Right Source, an online news portal. It'll take you to my blog, which is called Pro Libertate. When my book, Liberty in Eclipse, is ready, we will make it available through that website. That's rightsourceonline.com.
Rightsourceonline.com. And I recommend that you get William's material. He's certainly one of the clearest thinkers we have. And of course, when those books become available, let us know. We'll carry it here as well.
Thank you so much.
Well, we have 3 minutes to wrap up the program. The hour goes by so quickly, but you go ahead. What are your, where are we headed as far as this this economic situation? Is this just going to be a little temporary downturn, or do you think this is going to be a major cataclysmic event?
I don't think necessarily it's going to be a single cataclysm. I think it's going to be a protracted, agonizing decline punctuated by little mini cataclysms along the way. What we've seen over the last week or so, where the central bank in Europe, the European Union, Central Bank of Canada, and some other banks have moved into the breach to try to prop up the dollar, that's the kind of damage control we can expect to see, because there are a lot of people who are very much concerned and very much determined to maintain the system for as long as possible. And so I think we're going to be seeing more of that type of activity over the next couple of years. But it's going to be an activity that will yield diminishing returns. They simply cannot outpace the decline of the dollar. It's just not going to happen. And what I think is going to happen here domestically is that we're probably going to see, in perhaps the last stretch of George Bush's second term, we're probably going to see some overt movement toward actual self-identified tax increases. Bush has made a fetish out of not signing a tax increase, even though he has allowed inflation to run rampant, and that's, of course, the cruelest and most regressive tax. I think that whoever is elected president in 2008, unless that person is Ron Paul, is going to be governing as a hyper-Keynesian socialist, in terms of doing whatever is possible to inflate the money supply and stave off the huge consequences of the sell-off. The sell-off of our dollar-denominated assets is going to accelerate. I don't know if China is going to be the one who does it. I don't know if Saudi Arabia is going to be the one who does it. Chances are it'll be maybe both of them. It could be Japan, but the sell-off is going to become obvious, and it's going to have a real bite. We're going to start seeing prices jump when we go to the big box retailers. People are going to grow testier. Their resources are going to grow scarcer, and I think that a lot of households are going to be in for a lot of trouble, particularly when the energy prices take the same trajectory. You know, play things like heating oil during the winter and gasoline for traveling just about any time. So we're in for some really nasty times here.
I agree with you.
We're going to avoid them.
We're out of time. God bless. Thanks very much for being with us.
God bless.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, and I hope you enjoy our conversations with William Grieg every week. Certainly one of my favorite guests, and we have so many excellent guests. And you listen to Radio Liberty, you know we do 5 hours of talk radio a day, and we have some of the finest commentators you're going to find in the entire country. Anyway, we do hope that many of you will certainly want to listen to our other programs. They're available on the Genesis Network, on the American Freedom Network. They're summarized at our webpage, radioliberty.com. You can listen to our programs there at our webpage at radioliberty.com and through the Global Star stream 9 hours a day. You won't get much accomplished because 5 hours of that is actually replays, but we're there with Joyce Riley. Radio Liberty, listen to our programs, encourage others to listen. Have them go to our webpage. There are a lot of free videos. There are free newsletters. The programs are archived or an MP3. Get them listening. Get them educated. And help them, encourage them to join us in this epic struggle for the souls of men and the survival of Christian civilization. Because behind everything going on today are powerful spiritual forces. And if you've not yet read my book, Brotherhood of Darkness, you need to. To understand what's going on financially, you need to get my articles, my book, syllabus, on the financial tsunami. There's a talk that goes with that, either in DVD or in VHS. It's called Financial Tsunami. And then, of course, my pamphlet on the history of money, these things that you need to understand if you are going to have any hope of surviving what lies ahead. The book, The Creature from Jekyll Island by Ed Griffin that William mentioned. Then, of course, the book, The Federal Reserve Conspiracy by Professor Anthony Sutton. And lastly, the book entitled Fiat Money, Inflation in France, the story of what happened in France in 1789. And when you read that book, it's like deja vu all over again. Understand what has happened in the past, you'll be able to understand and prepare for the difficult times that lie ahead. On the other hand, understand that behind this, behind everything going on, are powerful spiritual forces, and of course, what you really need is a personal relationship with our Lord. If you'd like to get into the spiritual nature of this, you need to get our 4-tape set on the supernatural, and of course, Johanna Michelson's book, The Beautiful Side of Evil. You need to get certainly the book by Malachi Martin, Hostage to the Devil, and of course you can get the 4-tape set of my interviews with Malachi Martin, The Wisdom of Malachi Martin, and if you get the two of them together, with it, you'll get a special consideration. We hope many of you will want to join the Radio Liberty family of supporters. You'll want to read our latest newsletter, which deals with the financial problems we face today. As far as understanding our relationship to communism, you'll want to get our March, April, May, and June newsletters. We put them together in a pamphlet called The Communist-Capitalist Alignment. And that was a term that was used by Solzhenitsyn, the Communist-Capitalist Alignment. To understand what really happened on 9-1-1, you'll want to get our material on Foreknowledge 9-1-1. It's a group of three pamphlets. And then to understand the spiritual forces at work, the three pamphlet series, The Occult Hierarchy. The Occult Hierarchy. And ladies and gentlemen, there truly is an occult hierarchy that rules America and the world today. And believe me, many of these people are not of this world. So remember our number 1-800-544-8927. Please pray for America. Pray for revival. Pray for our leaders and our ministers. But please pray for Radio Liberty, for our provision and our protection. Until tomorrow, may the Lord be with you.
You're tuned to the Global Star Radio Network. Thanks for listening.
Many people ask questions.